And how big's the team?
Five of us.
Is that all it is?
Yeah, five of us.
Running a lot of money for five people.
Only 25 stocks, though. It's not the money.
No, it's not money.
It's other stocks, money. Yeah.
Is everyone analysts?
Yeah. Yeah.
Should we get cracking?
Yes. Yep, well, ready.
Finish asking your questions before we started.
I've finished asking my questions. Yeah, I'll be quiet for the hour now. So.
Good, thank you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell, episode 48, no less. We're delighted to be joined, as always, by James Hughes, back from his sickness. Yep. So that's good. He's lost a few kgs. Hopefully, he hasn't lost too much power on the bike. Also, delighted to be joined by Stephen Yu. Stephen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Stephen is the manager of the Blue Whale Growth Fund, a high conviction long-only global equity fund of 25 to 35 stocks, focused on developed markets, typically large cap growth bias with a market cap over 100 billion. The strategy is $1.7 billion. So in real money, that's about 1.2 billion sterling, right? And launched in 2017 and been very successful. So delighted to have you on, Stephen. Welcome to Quarter GVA HQ.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your time. It's hugely appreciated.
I mean, it's quite a lot. I don't really know where to start because it's it's only first week of March, yet it feels like the world has changed meaningfully in 2 months. We've had, DeepSeek was the middle of January, and that feels like a lifetime ago, doesn't it? Now, you've run the fund for 8 years now or so, isn't it? 2017. And, you know, clearly in that time, and indeed before that, like active versus passive is a sort of debate that doesn't really go away, and some might say that, you know, the evidence is pretty overwhelming. I mean, what kind of inspired you to set the fund up, and how do you think about kind of performance and outperformance over what has been a really tough benchmark to beat, isn't it, the global equity index MSCI World?
Yeah, thank you for that. So when I look back 7 or 8 years ago when the strategy was launched, I was very much convinced that we need to run a high conviction mandate with about 25 to 35 stocks. I think that gave us a higher chance to outperform our peers. If you look at funds typically in the IA global sector, you probably might have like 75 to 100 stocks. Yeah. So if you can run a higher conviction portfolios between, let's say, 25 stocks, then the chances of you outperforming some of your peers would be a lot higher than if you're running a similar number of stocks. So I think running a high conviction portfolio has always been a thing at Blue Whale, or maybe based on my previous experience. And of course, the journey started off just to be able to deliver a very good product versus our peers. And after 7.5 years, we have managed to do that. I think if you look at the performance since inception, it probably put us into the top 1% of best performing global funds out there. Okay. Yeah. But what we have learned, of course, over the last few years on the back of us, okay, have done a good job versus peers, is the rise of passive is actually a real competitor, or more real of a competitor going forward. And then when I look at some of my sector's performance last year, only 15% of the funds in the IA global sector outperformed the MSCI World Tracker. So of course, I mean, that is quite disappointing in a way that, hence we understand a lot of money are coming out from the active space, going to passive. And the one thing that I would say is the mentality, also the playbook to outperform your peers versus the passive, are very different. And I would imagine maybe over 20 years ago, you could be the number one fund in your sector, but then you underperformed the market. But the issue at the time wasn't that big just because you couldn't buy the market yourself. So in the global stock market context, there are about 1,500 stocks in MSCI World Index. You would not be able to trade 1,500 stocks 20 years ago. But of course, nowadays, anyone can just pay, I don't know, like 20 bips to buy a tracker, the iShares. And of course, then I think it does send a very strong signal to us and also maybe my industry that we need to justify why we are charging investors an active fee, which is the only thing that matters now going forward, is to outperform the passives.
Let me ask you a question that I'm often asked, which is, are the biggest stocks getting bigger, or have they done historically because of passive flows, that more money is going to the biggest stocks? Or is it just that we've been in this exceptional environment where the leading stocks have just been quite different and have just been better than other sectors? Because it's, you know, clients often say, well, it's obvious the share price of Apple goes up quicker because there's more money going to it because of the passives. Do you think that's just coincidental?
I think it's a combination of two things. Okay. Because when you look at the market value of a company, let's say the biggest companies in the world now mostly would be technology companies, that the earnings power as a starting point would be a key drivers. And of course, a second variable to that would be valuation. Mm-hmm. So then, of course, then you can then decide on whether Apple should be trading at 20 times earnings or maybe 30 times earnings. It's trading at close to 30 times earnings. Yeah. But of course, when you look at the earnings power of Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, Meta, Microsoft, and some others, even Nvidia, yeah, they are making a lot of money, right? And the one thing that we can all look back was that we are now spending a lot more of our time and money living in the digital world. Mm. Whether it's on a personal basis or maybe in a professional basis. Like, for example, we're doing this podcast. I was told that it's going to be on YouTube. Mm. This is in the digital world, which compared to before, it might not be the case. And when you then look into the companies that are providing us the capabilities, whether it's social media, your smartphone, your Teams or your Zoom, any of these services in the digital world, most of them would be the big tech companies.
Yeah.
So hence then, there's a natural shift over the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years, especially after, during the pandemic,
yeah,
a lot of the shift would basically just took place,
yeah,
given
yeah
that we were locked down at home. There's no choice not to do anything outside of the digital world. And so there's a permanent change of habits.
Mm.
And at the same time, what makes the conversation slightly more difficult is the moats of these companies have been very well entrenched. Because, for example, just think about WhatsApp. Like,
yeah,
is that an alternative to speak to your friends or family,
yeah,
across different platforms?
Yeah.
Outside WhatsApp, it's quite difficult to do. I'm sure there's a few other services, like maybe Apple iMessage or maybe other messaging services, but it's not cross-platforms. And then when you think about YouTube, there's a lot of content on that. Like, if you want to start up another video kind of platform, it's very difficult to build attraction, and of course, Amazon and some others. So then once a company such as some of these big tech companies have managed to establish themselves with the economy of scale, it's very difficult to break it. I think the only thing that could break their moat would be the government coming in to break them up at some point.
Yeah,
not,
okay.
I don't think we'll be under Trump's regime currently, but at some point they could become too powerful. I think they're already very powerful, right? When you look at the market cap of these companies, over $10 trillion, just a couple of them.
We've talked about this quite a lot, and we've gone from being worried about regulation to less concerned because of the sort of the intellectual war with China that we think, our view, it'd be interesting to see what you think, but our view is the US regulator is reluctant to do it because they want to win the intellectual war.
They don't
first
want to undermine their winners.
No,
do
they don't want to split these businesses because it will give almost it will be a benefit to China in terms of their businesses being able to take up the space. But I don't know what your views are.
Yeah, we would agree with that, yeah, because when you look at AI today, it has become the national interest.
Yeah.
It's a bit like your defense, but in a very different setting, right? And of course, I think on the back of DeepSeek, if you recall what Trump said in the media just about maybe on the same day or on Tuesday that week, he basically made a comment on that the big tech company in the US need to get your act together.
Sure.
Because suddenly become a race. Because before DeepSeek, everyone was thinking, okay, we have this advantage or
yeah
competitive leap against the rest of the world. And suddenly DeepSeek arriving, and then everyone's woken up, or maybe we need to do a better job. And so it has become a national interest in terms of the tech dominance. And then on top of that, you have AI now. So you are probably right that the risk of them being broken up in the next couple of years will be quite low. But then I think what I'm trying to suggest is they are just becoming a lot more powerful. And at some point, they could actually be too dominant that
yeah
we would then reverse course to say that, okay, maybe now you need to take a yeah pause on yeah this.
But I mean, like Netflix and Facebook didn't really exist even 20 years ago, did they? And Amazon was only 30 years old. Probably a bit more than that, but it's amazing how big these businesses have become relatively quickly. And you sort of think, well, how have they come so big? How did they get so big? Well, if you think about Amazon's probably the best example, you know, think of all those local bookshops who've gone out of business. And that's, you know, that value of a corporate entity, if you like, is translated from your local bookstore into Amazon.com. And it's the same for, you know, Netflix and YouTube. Where's the value that they created come from? It's come from traditional linear television networks, not
yeah
and newspapers, not getting as much of our time, and more of our time's going to an online world. But you know, I guess we've always had, I think the stat is that since the S&P, and I heard it this morning on a podcast, which is why it's top of my mind, since the S&P 500 was initiated in 1957, only 57 of the original 500 stocks are still in the list. So 90% of the stocks 50, 60 years ago have gone. And it's likely that the level of turnover in indexes, is it going to be higher going forward? It sort of definitely feels like things are moving quicker. I mean, how do you think about that in terms of, you know, those big names, whether it's an Amazon or a Netflix, which you don't own, but or a Microsoft? I mean, are these businesses, yes, they seem pretty entrenched, but are we going to be sat here in 20 years and are they still going to be the Magnificent Seven, or are they going to be a woman? There's clearly going to be others, but, and how do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So from our perspective, that where we are today, positioned today, that we are underweight to Mag 7. Mm-hmm. So when we look at our positioning, we have about 10% exposure to Mag 7. Okay. The only stock that we really like is NVIDIA and a bit of Meta. Mm-hmm. And then compared to the MSCI World Index, which is about 25%. So we're actually underweight. But we do have other stocks that are a lot better than the Mag 6, which are TSMC or Broadcom, that we owned a big position in. Hence, we are doing quite well, even though that we were underweight the Mag 7.
Yeah.
But I think the way to think about this, or how we are thinking about this, is the landscape for the Mag 6 mostly, or maybe Mag 5 outside of Apple, is that they have become a lot more capital intensive, right? This year, they're spending over $300 billion in capital expenditure to invest into AI.
Yeah.
And we would rather, from an investor perspective, we would rather to be on the receiving end of that AI spending, right? I don't want to be exposed to AI spenders, because those money, the $300 billion, have gone into the revenue of either NVIDIA or Broadcom, right? Yeah. NVIDIA this year is going to deliver just about $200 billion of revenue with a very high margin. And if you look at the free cash flow generation from NVIDIA this year, that number is higher than Microsoft. It's the number two company in the world, just a bit behind Apple. But where is this free cash flow coming from? It's coming from the free cash flow of Microsoft. So then a lot of free cash flow are being transferred away from the big tech to the AI infrastructure companies. Mm. So this is what we are concerned about. So what we are saying today is, while we are exiting Microsoft, it is a stock that we have owned for 7 years, consistently featured in our top 10 holdings for 7 years until August last year. And we have been gradually selling. The reason being was because we think the business model is changing. For them to offer Office 365 Copilots, they would need to invest a lot of money into AI. Mm. Compared to before, just to offer us the OneDrive, the Office 365 subscription is just a bit of cloud storage in terms of our emails or some of our documents. So they're now being very dependent in terms of some other suppliers, which is either their in-house GPUs or NVIDIA GPUs. So then the return on investor capital profile is going to come down, or the margin is unlikely to expand like before. It's probably going to come down a bit. But then, from our understanding, it's just because the moat that this company have established themselves in terms of the subscription-based model, everything is on cloud. We are very dependent on them. They're very powerful, very generative, cash generative. It's difficult to see that, to see them disappearing. So I would expect them to be around for much longer than most people would imagine, compared to the last 50 years, because a lot of those companies would be operating in the physical domain, which then you don't get the economy of scale, right? If you think about AI, what AI is a simple algorithm.
Yeah.
When I say simple, probably not so simple to us, but simple in a way that is all about analytics, right? It's a large language model that look at a lot of data and try to come up with some use cases or some analytics that is very useful to us that we couldn't be able to do so without AI. And all the data is now readily available in the cloud, whether it's your personal data through your WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook, or you watch YouTube, the history of that, your Gmails, and a lot of things. And at the same time, in the professional world, your OneDrive, I mean, we are Microsoft user, a lot of our documents, our financial modeling, or anything, we use Teams. And so a lot of things are already in the cloud in itself. So what it means is AI just need to come in to do it. So then if you're a new company, it's a lot more difficult for you to do that, right? Because even though AI is a new trend, many of these companies that I just talk about, they were a bit behind the curve, because OpenAI created ChatGPT, not Microsoft, not Google, not Meta, and some others. So they were a bit behind the curve. Yeah. But for them to catch up, it's a lot easier than if you haven't got that first mover advantage in terms of being quite entrenched. But I think the important point, though, which I think investors need to remember, is being established, being around, doesn't make you an outperformer. Because from our perspective, is to deliver outperformance versus the market.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the luxury of being an active manager is you can run ahead of the index composition.
Mm-hmm.
Just like before, we have spotted 6 out of 8 trillion dollar companies back in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the companies that we had at the time, Meta, Microsoft, Alphabet, and Amazon, they were only at around $500 billion company.
Yeah,
at the time, there wasn't any trillion dollars. I mean, Apple was the first, probably in 2018, and then later on, then you have the other to follow. And of course, over the last 3 years, we had Nvidia and Broadcom.
Mm-hmm.
And so the index in itself, the tracker in itself, cannot spot companies. They is a reflection of what these companies have achieved over time. Of course, then they deploy more capital if you're buying into passive, and then they just put more money into the company that have become bigger. So then what I'm trying to say here is it works the other way around too. So if we are right on this, we're saying, okay, the Mag 6 is unlikely to be outperformer. They might be underperforming. So what it means is the market cap is going to either stay unchanged or maybe it's going to come down for a bit. But the weighting, the relative weighting is going to be coming down. So then we could be ahead of the curve if we are right on this. And of course, then the index would take a long time to reflect that journey over time. So, but I think from our perspective, it's very difficult apart from government intervention that could actually
could upset
disable to upset the ecosystem.
That kind of hyperscaler CapEx, you're basically talking Amazon, Google, Meta, and Microsoft, the four of them. You know, they're spending a lot of money basically on chips from NVIDIA and building big sheds to put them in, as far as I can tell. I mean, part of the kind of bear case, if you like, why people don't like NVIDIA is, yes, they're going to grow. They've grown their revenue hugely over the last year or two. And again, decent growth this year. But does that hyperscaler CapEx, does that carry on at that level for the next 5 years, or does it normalize? I mean, are we in a sort of peak front loading of building the sheds with the chips, and then in 2026, maybe 2027, they don't spend $300 billion, they spend $50 billion or $75 billion because they've done it? Is that a sort of risk to NVIDIA? And, you know, in that sense, is NVIDIA's revenue artificially high and set to normalize quite meaningfully? Or do you think that these levels of revenue that they're generating can be sustained, albeit not probably growing at the same rate that they've done?
So this would depend on how much you believe in AI.
Mm.
Do you believe AI is going to change the world?
Yeah.
Or do you believe that everything that we've seen to date is the end of the AI applications development?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you tell me that AI is about ChatGPT, Midjourney, image generation, summarizing certain documents or writing an email or even transcribing a conference call real time.
Mm-hmm.
All this, we probably got too many GPUs already. I think DeepSeek have solved all the equation that we need in terms of the cost of training a model to get to where we got to today. That is not our view. Our view is we are at the early innings of the development of AI.
Okay.
And of course, by lowering the cost of training, is actually very helpful to allow many more startups to come into play.
Yeah.
So if you think about many years ago, about 15 years ago, when Apple launched iPhone back in 2008 and 9, just imagine how many apps were on the smartphone, right? Mm-hmm. It's probably about 100, I would remember. But nowadays, there are a few millions apps. Like, I have no idea like how people would have actually tested a few million apps themselves individually. I probably have 100 apps in my phone, but I would have no idea or no time to figure out what the other few millions apps are. But the reason that the smartphone is so, the apps ecosystem is so strong is because smartphone has been very well penetrated within the developed market community, right? I would imagine probably over 90% of people in the developed market would have a smartphone. And of course, at the same time, the cost of a low-end smartphone, not the highest spec one, will probably cost you $200, which is good enough for most people. If you're not so sophisticated, you don't need the fastest smartphone on earth. But at the same time, just because you'll probably be using some apps, and from an app developer perspective or company perspective, you only need to have, I don't know, maybe 50,000 or 100,000 users that are very loyal to your apps that you and I don't like. Like, we would never use those apps, but we have our own prefer apps that we want to use, and it make it very economical for the developers. Scalable. Who actually for them, right? Like, you don't need to have like the billions of users. I mean, of course, there's some really powerful apps like WhatsApp, of course. I mean, you have like 3 billion users using WhatsApp, but not every apps would be like that, and you don't need to be in order to have a business. So what we are saying here is there's a lot of AI development that we have not yet seen. And of course, the one starting point, the most important starting point to do anything in the AI domain is trainings. Mm-hmm. If you have done the trainings, you can optimize, you can do the inferencing that you can potentially bring it in-house to do the in-house GPUs. Hence, you might not be using NVIDIA's product, like the big tech are now building their own, like, for example, Alphabet is having their own TPUs.
Yeah.
But it's very specific, right? Like, let's say, imagine like what Google is doing for YouTube. Okay, we go to YouTube to watch a video.
Mm.
The only AI bit, I would imagine, is basically to learn about what we like or don't like.
Mm-hmm.
So if you spend 10 seconds watching this video and then start clicking on another one, then YouTube will probably work out that you don't like that. So by the time they want to make a recommendation to you, they would be a bit smarter, right?
Yeah.
So then it's a real-time recommendation based on your preferences, based on your behavior within the ecosystem. When do you actually like to watch videos and all that? And what is the maybe a typical length of that journey? So it's a very specific AI applications. So Google has done that using in-house GPU now rather than using NVIDIA. Yeah. But of course, before they manage to get to that conclusion, they will need to do the trainings.
Yeah.
And I got a few more examples, depends on how much time we want to spend on AI. Is the two, the one very exciting thing about AI is the AI agent, which is something that we have not seen. And it's going to help us to do a lot of the tasks that's being performed by humans today.
So I've got a story about this. I've got a client of mine, actually. He works in the digital team at one of the major airlines. And as part of his role, they are bringing in the AI agent.
Mm.
Probably in place of the call center, but as a sort of first step. So if your flight gets cancelled and you want to rebook it, you can talk to the agent, and it's an AI tool, basically, and it will do it all for you, and it will book it for you, and it will send you the confirmation to everything, as opposed to having to speak to a call handler, a human being, essentially. Now, that might upset many, but it's kind of a next progression of what we've already got, isn't it? So you're absolutely right about these agents. Does seem to be the next.
I mean, and it makes sense, because why do you have a human being sitting there repeating the same thing, the same bit of information again and again and again?
It's not highly productive work, is it?
No. It makes, you know, it does.
Yeah, because
sense.
If you think about this, right, previously we have AI chatbots, which I think on some websites still have that.
Yeah.
But AI chatbot is quite a primitive use case, right?
All you ever do with a chatbot is try and get past the chatbot so you can get a real agent in there. And when it says, I'm transferring to a real agent, you're like, yeah, I've won the game. So having an AI agent makes sense.
So that's right. So basically what AI agent is a more advanced version of an AI chatbot that's going to be linked to the backend system. Mm. So let's say I imagine from a BA perspective, they would have an AI agent for their accounting system, one for their booking system, one for their flight scheduling system, one for the customer record system.
Yeah.
And of course, then you also have an interface that deal with customers, like your flight is canceled, you want to speak to that agent, let's say AI agent, AI chatbot, and then the AI chatbot or AI agent would then interact with the other AI agents that can verify what you're saying is real, right? You can't just make things up.
Yeah,
and then of course, once the AI agent is linked up with the backend system, which is now, that's what we are looking forward to, then the task in itself could be completed.
Mm.
With no human interference, right? Of course, I'm sure there will be some oversight or checks in place just to make sure BA is not going to give you more money than they need to. So that would be a bit of checking behind the scene. But then a lot of this automation could be done on itself.
Because that's a big problem in lots of businesses, isn't it? Not just travel businesses, but banks, for instance. You've got lots of legacy systems that have been there for 20, 30 years. And they don't talk to each other. So, you know, part of what lots of white-collar people are doing, not looking at myself in the slightest, is essentially moving stuff from one of your systems to another to produce something that's work.
Mm.
So if an AI agent can effectively sit there between them all or a couple of them and sit on top of each of their siloed systems, then all of a sudden white-collar work becomes potentially quite a lot more productive, subject to, obviously, checks and balances in the system and big red buttons that you just turn off.
Yeah, the other one, which is I think is coming for, this is my view on this, is a personal AI agent.
Mm-hmm.
So the only one stock that we like within the Mac 6 is Meta. Mm. Okay, but I would say that it's relatively expensive in terms of free cash flow yield just because they are spending a lot of money investing in the AI. PE ratio is a bit cheaper, but that's a bit misleading.
Mm.
So then, okay, whether you would expect that you can ride this out because the valuation is a bit more expensive, but then there's a lot of potential why we like Meta over in the long run, maybe not so much on valuation ground, is because they have the largest amount of data about consumers. They have over 3 billion of users, right? From WhatsApp, Instagram and Facebook, right? 3 billion users. So what I would imagine is happening already, I'm guessing, of course, Zuckerberg's not going to tell you that it's happening, is that there's a lot of AI learnings through my WhatsApp histories, through my Instagram, what I like, what I post, who are my friends, maybe my Facebook domain, etc. And then ultimately, he would create an AI agent for everyone individually. They would have learned about how you speak, how you communicate with your family, with your friends, with your colleagues, what sort of things you like, because you have a lot of social media stuff that you have given them the access to free of charge.
They got in trouble recently for having robot Facebook users, didn't they? That were essentially machines in there that were impersonating. But essentially just learning. I mean, it's just a learning model, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's about learning. Yeah. But I think what is then really powerful, once that has been done, so of course, then you do require a lot of GPUs to do that training, right? You were talking about 3 billion of individual agents based on your personal preferences. Mm. Not your one is not going to be the same as mine with some minor differences, etc. Or maybe your families or partners. But what is going to be really exciting, which I'm now maybe visualizing that is going to happen, is if my flights got canceled by BA, I'm not going to do it myself. I'm going to send my agent.
Mm.
My agent knows that I got my itinerary.
Yeah.
He knows the agent would have gone through my email box to know that I have paid for this amount. I send my Stephen agent to talk to the BA agent and just get my refund back.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant.
That's not negative for NVIDIA, is it?
In terms of trainings, I think this is the thing about AI. It's a bit different to the cloud in a way that when you think about the hyperscale cloud data center, the investment that have been made many years ago, it's all about storage of data, isn't it? Okay, you have more things that you want to digitize rather than in paper's form. You put it into the cloud. You want to move from the on-prem data center to the cloud so that everyone can have access to it rather than it's confined to your within your local community or your region. But AI is different in a way that you need to continue to invest money to perform the trainings if you can find new use cases.
Okay.
And of course, we haven't even talked about the industry vertical AI. Like Bloomberg is embracing AI to do the learnings on all the transcripts, news flow, the price data on the Bloomberg terminal.
Yeah, that's a company.
And I would expect that's going to be one for the pharmaceutical industries. One for maybe financial advisory, like you make it so specific to your country that you have all the tax kind of policy in there. And then it's very different, going to be different to the US, very different to Asia and some other places. And then you go in there to ask very specific questions and you can get the solutions. Because at the moment, what we are seeing in ChatGPT is a general purpose.
Yeah.
Search engine.
Yeah.
So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. And sometimes you thought like, okay, maybe that's not that smart.
Mm.
Because it's just the starting point.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then how do you then refine the queries or the outputs? You need to spend a bit more money to do the trainings, right? It's very specific to your domain.
And then like on that sort of industry type applications, I'm right in thinking you've got some London Stock Exchange or LSEG as it's now in the portfolio.
Yep.
Got a soft spot for the London market. So, and it's fair to say that the London Stock Exchange, as it was known, PLC, LSEG as it's known now, isn't just the business that owns the rights to the FTSE 100, right, on the London market. It is a data company in its own right, not dissimilar to Bloomberg. Stock's been really strong, actually, for a number of years, and it's one of the UK's kind of highest quality businesses, and we don't have that many here, do we? Still keen on that, still kind of happy to own that, and what are your sort of thoughts on how that's going to
Yeah, so LSEG is an interesting one. It, for us, it's not a big position. It's one of our few, very few UK stocks that we have in the fund today. But what makes it a bit interesting was a few years ago when they acquired Refinitiv, which is the data business, that when you look at the composition of the group now, the London Stock Exchange, the IPO market, is only 3% of the group. So even though it's still called London Stock Exchange Group or LSEG, it's a bit misleading because it's all about data now. 50% of the business is in data. But what makes it a bit more interesting today compared to before was that they had this partnership with Microsoft. It's trying to embrace a bit of AI in terms of their workspace or what is used to be called Icon system, which is very similar to Bloomberg. And from our understanding that the penetration of the workspace product is more in the middle to back office space, less so in the front office. Compared to Bloomberg, it's mostly in the front office. So what it means is in the back to middle office space, that of course there's a lot of reporting in banks, for example, a lot of trading, reconciling different trades has been inputted into the system for clients, cash position and all that. And if they could actually get the AI working, it could actually increase a lot of efficiency for the large banks who is actually dealing with a lot of clients. And of course, I would imagine then if we they could allow, they can increase efficiency in the bank, they would be able to charge a higher fees to the banks, which is basically another way of automating certain things that's now being done by human that is very labor intensive. So we think LSEG might have a chance of achieving that.
I mean, just for the listeners and viewers, I mean, we have a relationship with LSEG and we use the Workspace platform for our data and et cetera. A few colleagues got Bloomberg, et cetera. And it is really good. But you could sort of see how integrating an AI application into it would be really helpful. So I could go in and say, can you make me a chart of, rather than me trying to like fish around, trying to find the right codes and the right timescales and make it look pretty, you know, it's sort of, anyway, that's very fascinating. It's really interesting.
Do you think, going back to the hyperscalers, just quickly, is your view that they have to keep spending this CapEx to stay in front and essentially to keep the moats around them, and actually in the short term, shareholders might just have to suffer with that extra CapEx spend, but in order to gain for the future, you know, put that investment in? Or do you think at some stage there's pressure from shareholders, which is the returns and free cash flow just isn't good enough, you've got to stop spending?
I think it's probably going to, it's coming. I think the pressure from shareholders is probably going to come maybe later this year or definitely from next year onwards, because when you think about CapEx spending, $300 billion, it doesn't feature into their P&L. There's no impact in terms of like expectations and all that, right? But it's coming. That is going to be depreciation, right? So then, of course, they try to depreciate as long as they could, but it's still going to come in. So all the money that I've spent over the last 2 years, including this year, is going to come into play, I would say, from next year onwards.
Yeah.
But then you probably still, we will start seeing signs of that happening, right? Then the shareholder would be asking. So the cost base has increased, even though it's not a cash item because they already spent the money, but then your revenue is not increasing as quickly. So what is going on? Because the good example that I want to use is Alphabet. So Google Search have got 90% market share for a long time. But then they decided to launch Google Gemini last year, which is a competing product to ChatGPT. They have to invest a lot of money into AI infrastructure to develop Google Gemini, because Google Search was basically a product that has already quite established and there's no competition. It's 90% market share, very generative. It is a cash cow for Google, right? Like it accounts for like 80% of the revenue or profits. And but the reason they're doing this is not because they think they're going to win. Of course, they would think they're going to win. But if they decide not to do it tomorrow, the free cash flow for Alphabet would go up, but they might disappear in 10 years' time.
Yeah.
Because everyone then decided, oh, actually, ChatGPT is pretty good, isn't it? Maybe you, and then maybe ChatGPT come up with other products that are very interesting that's built on the back of AI, and then you build an ecosystem like Google has done with the YouTube, the Google Maps, and Gmails, and a few other things going on there. And so then it become more of an existential crisis. But it doesn't mean you, when you spend the money, you will make it work. but it's a ticket to join the race, right? You want to race in a marathon, doesn't mean you're going to win the marathon. But if you don't pay that money, then you're just not part of this race, which is very important.
Yeah. It's the classic innovator's dilemma, isn't it? You know, if you have to disrupt yourself in order to still be potentially be in the game, and you might not, there's no odds, you know, it's not 100% odds of success. Google might not win in ChatGPT, might be the number one, Gemini might not be the number one. Like, and that search business, are we still going to be doing Google searches in 5-10 years time the way we are today? Or do we just go and ask ChatGPT? Or do we go and ask something else? Or we have like a range of applications for different...
I mean,
do we go straight into YouTube and search?
Will you even look at a screen in terms of your chat function, or will you just talk to the device or whatever it is? You know, all this time spent doing this, you know, potentially that changes. Yeah. You've got something in your ear or whatever else.
No, totally agree.
I was going to say, I think last year you only 10% of the portfolio was in the Mag 7, is that right?
Yeah, we're currently just about 10%.
Yeah, but yet you outperformed the market, which is pretty incredible based on how dominant that Mag 7 was. But where, you know, that's obviously worked very well, but where are you seeing sort of the opportunities now? And also, I wanted to ask a bit around kind of your process and learnings, and, you know, where does the process come from? It's kind of where have you... You know, what's the background to how you run money and think about the world?
Yeah, so I will probably answer this backwards and come back to the today, which will be relevant too. So I have done many things in my previous career before I started Bluewell. But when I look at the composition of the team, which I would say that is not a cool... It's not by design. Maybe it's a coincidence, but probably it's not a coincidence that there are five of us on the investment team, but four of us used to work at some hedge fund setup.
Okay.
So I think that experience, including my previous experience running hedge fund money, is that the mentality or maybe the timing of us getting involved with certain things is a bit more on top than maybe a traditional long-only manager that you just say, okay, I take a long-term view. We all do that, right? But then maybe we would monitor the shorter-term news flow more closely. We follow quarterly earnings. We build financial model ourselves. We don't speak to a sell-side research analyst. We don't read brokers' research.
Really,
so we do everything in-house. Like, we can act just without speaking to anyone. I think that is a very strong advantage, right? When we look at results, we can make a decision ourselves without calling anyone up to give us a second take. Mm-hmm. So I think that level of research and the mentality, I think that helps a lot. But the one thing that I would say that I have learned and that have probably allowed us to have done quite well over different periods, of course, I mean, we did underperform in 2022, but before then and after that, I mean, we did very well, is investing into companies. It's not just quality. Quality we love. I think everyone understands quality. Yeah. Everyone can define high quality businesses without us talking about it. Quality growth, company that can grow, I think that's quite easy too. But how do you outperform? So I try to come up with this new term called quality growth outperformers, not quality growth underperformers, right? Like, you could be both. Okay. But how do you then translate something into an outperformance? I would probably say that you want to become the priority of anyone who wants to spend money. So if you think about many years ago, let's say before the pandemic, we were heavily exposed to digital transformation opportunities, which encompass e-commerce, digital payments, digital advertising, software, cloud, etc. Mm-hmm. They were doing quite well, quality, a bit of growth, a lot of the FANGs we used to own, we no longer own today. But during the pandemic, they became the priority.
Mm-hmm.
Priority in a way that we have no alternative. If you want to still be alive, you need to shop online, right? You cannot just go onto High Street to do anything. There's no shops open. So you need to open an account with Amazon if you haven't got one. You need to have a wallet with PayPal or maybe join Apple Pay, or at least you need to have a credit card so they can make payments. And then if you are working for a company, you're working from home, you need to sign up with Microsoft.
Yeah.
That is as simple as that, right? You haven't got it. You just don't have the ability to work from home. That's very simple. So everyone at the same time decided to spend the money with only a handful of companies, which we were talking about earlier, right? Mm. Only a handful of them offered that. And then they experienced what I would call the explosive growth because you became the priority. Okay, what do we have now in the last few years? AI as a starting point. Forget about for a second the monetization, whether AI is real or not. Just think for a second that the biggest company in the world, the Mag 6 have decided this is going to be our top priority. We are going to spend $300 billion. I don't care what shareholders are going to think. I don't care whether AI is going to work out or not. I'm not even thinking about how we're going to monetize this. Mm. And these companies have been around for years, right? They have gone through the tech bubble, like Amazon, Alphabet, and all that. It's not like they haven't seen the world. So sometimes it puzzles me. There's a lot of conflict when you hear from another fund manager say, okay, I don't believe in AI. I don't invest in the NVIDIA or I don't believe in it. But then they are very happy shareholder of the big tech companies, which have decided to spend all your money that's supposed to belong to you into the things that you do not believe in. Mm-hmm. That I find it a bit puzzling, right? But before we talk about anything else, it has become the priority. Mm-hmm. So then another area that is very interesting today is defense, European defense. So we have this company called Leonardo, Italian defense company. It's done very well. Of course, this year has gone up 70%. But the way that you think about it is, of course, defense companies are not new. But suddenly, it just become the highest priority in the European Union, right? Leonardo's, like, they just decided to change the fiscal discipline.
Yeah. It's like a high-tech defense business as well, isn't it?
Yeah, of course, yes.
So they don't just do, like, guns and
No, it's not that. It's not that.
Guns and grenades.
Yeah, it's not that. It's about self-defense, right? It's more high-tech. But I think the thing to remember is it has become the highest priority.
Yeah.
Like, even Germany is really to change the fiscal discipline.
It's unbelievable.
So then where would you want to be? Because ultimately, we all know this is a zero-sum game. The money is going to come from somewhere, right? It's going to come from the German bond yield has gone up, so the taxpayer is going to pay for that. But then European Union just decided, okay, the US has decided to disappear, covering us. We need to have the capability to defend ourselves. So this is where I feel like if you can find these kind of companies or sectors that could become the priority. I mean, of course, we have other stuff like maybe Philip Morris or US sports gaming, Flutter. That you make a lot of money within a short space of time.
Yeah, Flutter's a business that was listed in London, and it was Paddy Power? No.
Sky Bet was part of it, wasn't it? Yeah. Went in.
So it's a conglomerate, isn't it?
They have many brands.
Brands. It's now listed in the US. It's one of our more successful tech businesses, if you call it a tech business, I guess.
That's why it's no longer UK listed.
It's not UK listed. One of the other good ones. Yeah, I mean, is that kind of sports gambling growth in the States? Is that set to continue, and is Flutter going to remain dominant in that? Or because there's an element of 2021, we were all sat at home with nothing else to do, and Americans had their stimulus checks in the bank. You know, what else are they going to do apart from gamble on it? Is that sustainable? Is there still a runway for growth there? And is the total addressable market big enough for these stocks to keep growing?
Yeah, this is very exciting from our perspective, because it's very idiosyncratic. Mm-hmm. It's not depending on Trump. So where we are today is sports gaming in the US only started to become legal to do so a few years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the landscape today, it's about 50% of the population or 50% of the states have legalized sports gaming.
Because it's state-led, isn't it?
Yeah, the state by gambling. State level. Yeah. So hence, like, we would expect more states is going to legalize sports gaming in the next coming years. But two things that we know, which is, I think, very important to address the market, the size of the market. One is the US sports market is significantly bigger than the rest of the world sports market, right? Mm-hmm. Like the NFL and the Super Bowl and some other stuff, the NBA and other bits and pieces. And secondly, so that we know, Americans love the sport.
Yep.
So sport is not something new to them. They already spend a lot of money, not on the betting side, but with sports. And secondly, of course, American consumers are a lot more wealthier than the rest of the world, right? Yeah. They're probably the wealthiest people now on a very high level. And thirdly, when we look at the sports gaming market in the US, it's a two-place market. It's a duopoly between Flutter's brand called FanDuel versus DraftKings, which is also a listed company in the US. Yeah. Yeah. These two companies control over 80% of the market share per individual state, different states.
I heard that Charles Schwab and Robin Hood were thinking about having sports betting added onto their platform as well. And they think that normal private retail clients will have, on the one side, the options, which they go mad for on stocks, and on the other side, they have the sports betting as kind of part of their profile. I mean, it seems alien to us, but I think this opening up you're talking about, I mean, it's a huge opportunity, isn't it?
Yeah, and of course, then, I mean, over time, when the market become very exciting, I mean, or very promising. Like, you would expect to see competitors coming in. But of course, like FanDuel and DraftKings have been operating in the US for about 5 years now. Yeah. They have a national recognition because like you would see the brand when you watch the Super Bowl and some other stuff, even though that it might not be available in your own state. Yeah. And at the same time, there's a lot of what we call the economy scale in terms of pricing certain bets or how, what sort of bets they will offer to you in terms of know-how, in terms of analytics. Mm. Of course, I'm sure new players could come in, but then maybe the offering is not going to be as sophisticated. And I think in particular for Flutter, as you rightly mentioned, it's conglomerates that they do operate in Australia, operate in Europe, operate in the UK. I think there's a lot of learnings that they could borrow to the US sports market, right? Because ultimately it's a completely different market, but then it's kind of the same dynamics in a very different setting. But if you're a completely new company like Charles Schwab or Robin Hood coming in, like, how do you actually price the bets to start with, right? Yeah. Like, to make it very interesting for your consumer or users to participate.
And what sort of valuation is Flutter on?
It's probably about 30 times. Yeah. 30 times earnings. Yeah. Growing very fast.
Going back to priorities, the sort of sector that stands out to me that, unless I've missed it, you haven't really got exposure to, would be the obesity drugs, which I would have thought that's a pretty high priority for a lot of consumers now. And, you know, I know people that take the drugs and it's completely changed their lives. And I think, you know, I think the potential appetite for more, appetite is probably the wrong word, but kind of the demand for these drugs is probably going to grow. Have you looked at these stocks or... you know, are they interesting to you or just too expensive?
Yeah, so the short answer, the quick answer on that was we missed it a few years ago. I think we were very focused on AI about two years ago, so we didn't spend too much time on the GLP-1. So we missed that boat in the last 2 years. But of course, since then, we have done work on those stocks. And I think the one thing that we are not being convinced about is the competition they're coming in to the market, right? Yeah, yeah. So we agree completely about the GLP-1 adoption globally will be going up significantly from here.
Yeah.
But then ultimately, the question about when you make an investment decision is whether the company that you're investing into, who has been the first mover, who had been the market leader, could continue that leadership when you have more generics coming in. Because I think if you use this the same mindset to, let's say, to look into the AI infrastructure companies, let's say NVIDIA GPUs or Broadcom in-house GPUs, is we just cannot see new companies coming in. Okay, potentially you might have the Chinese, let's say Huawei could end up maybe launching a GPU. It's going to be very difficult, but maybe they are able to do it. It's not coming over here to start with, right? No big tech companies are going to buy Huawei's GPU to run the YouTube algorithm or, I don't know, WhatsApp. It's just not coming over here for now, right? Anyway, it's not going to be allowed, right? Like Huawei, we've ripped out all the Huawei 5G product in the UK, for example. And at the same time, when people talk about NVIDIA, I still got asked about this question. What is the moat of NVIDIA? The one number I would probably ask people to remember is globally that just about 6 million software developers that are using NVIDIA's CUDA platform to develop AI applications. Of course, these 6 million people didn't just appear, right? You're talking about NVIDIA's been around for 20 years before recently. They were a pioneer in GPU capability in gaming, later on crypto mining, later on a bit of a real-time recommendation engine for YouTube and some others. Yeah. And now, of course, you have the GPT technology. So any AI application have been developed today or maybe have been studied or tested by scientists, by the PhDs, would have used NVIDIA GPUs to do it, right? So then if you then tell me, okay, AMD is going to launch AI, which they are, And they would need to firstly convince anyone. Do you want to come into my ecosystem? It's a bit like you're launching an app store.
Yeah, exactly.
Who can actually launch an app store? Even though if you're Microsoft or Meta or Amazon, you cannot launch an app store.
You never go
because you do not have the traction. No software developer is going to listen to you unless you pay them. You pay me 100K or $1 million, I'm going to write you an app. Yeah. But then that's not sustainable, right? You want people to do it themselves. And the reason people are writing apps just for iOS and Android's app store is because the ecosystem has already been established. You already got a user base, the user base, paying users to sustain that ecosystem. Yeah. So it's very difficult. And hence, when Zuckerberg at the time, I don't know what he's doing now in Metaverse, we did not like the idea. So we actually sold out of the companies back in January 2022. But then we reinitiated our position in Q4 2023, which did very well for us because he have now shift focus from Metaverse to AI. But the one bit that we didn't like on Metaverse was that he would need to convince a lot of software developers to develop a new ecosystem, right? So, okay, Apple was attempting to do a bit of a virtual reality thing. It wasn't successful, but there's a higher chance for Apple to make it work.
Yeah.
Just because they already have a few million apps and then you just need to convince a few, oh, I got these smart glasses, can you try to work something out? But then if you haven't got anything, it's just going to be a very expensive and time-consuming journey. I'm sure it could work, but it could be a 20-year project rather than a five-year project.
I remember that January 2022 because it was basically, well, it wasn't a profits warning as such, wasn't it? The stock dropped about 15% a day because he said he was going to spend, I'm going to say it was $20 billion or something on the metaverse. And we then had the spectacle of Nick Clegg, because he used to be their policy, like doing, he did a video for the FT in the metaverse and the little avatars sat in a room and they're sort of head bobbing around. It was very strange. I was always somewhat skeptical of that metaverse story.
They're creating about 80%.
80%, 70% top to bottom. But to be fair to him, talking about good capital allocation, he clearly realised that was the wrong thing to do, wrong horse to back, let's get off it, cut our losses now whilst we can. The AI story for Facebook or Meta is very strong, and he's done a really good job of pivoting to that. And the share price is way higher than it was.
Yeah, the difference as if you just compare the two, right? The CapEx is a lot higher now compared to the Metaverse number a few years ago. But Metaverse was a new thing.
Yeah.
You need to create a new, entirely new ecosystem, which don't know who is going to take it up. Is people going to pay for this? Do we actually want to live in the Metaverse? Probably not for me yet. Maybe another pandemic for a few longer years, maybe we are forced to live in the Metaverse, but maybe not so soon. But then when you compare his spending investment decision in AI, it's a lot more straightforward. AI is a simple algorithm just to learn about anything that's in front of you, which is data. And Meta has got all the data available. So then he's just basically buying all the GPU from NVIDIA to overlay that with his Llama model and the different things that's going on behind the scene to come up with some good use cases. So then when you look at that, the kind of the journey of them making it work, it's a lot more straightforward than building an entire metaverse ecosystem from scratch. Which hence, I think investors like that. Investors probably can see that happening quicker. So then at some point, you can see the revenue generation coming in.
And the stock was pretty cheap, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When that happened, the stock was down on 10, 12 times earnings or something silly. And they've had a sort of upswing in the because ultimately 98% of the revenue is from advertising or something like that. So advertising market has been very strong because the economy has been strong. It is a cyclical business. You know, Ben says that. Google and Facebook are both advertising businesses, and advertising is cyclical. When we get a recession, people don't advertise holidays and ski holidays and trips to Piedmont to, you know, drink wine, etc. So, you know, fascinating. Hughes, have you got any more questions before we call it a day?
I mean, I do, but we probably exhausted our listeners. So
exhausted ourselves.
Exhausted, yeah. No, I think that was really interesting.
Yeah, and it was great, actually, not to have to talk about geopolitics and trade wars and tariffs and Ukraine and China.
Ultimately, none of us have the answer, do we? So there's no point in spending time.
We can talk about it. So. And fascinating, Stephen. Thank you very much for your time today. It's really interesting. Some good outcomes, some good stocks, and some good performance track record. So keep it going.
Yeah, amazing track record. Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. Let's see it continue.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Any emails, questions via email to james.hughes@quarterachiever.com or I am jonathan.raymond@quarterachiever.com, which is possibly the longest email address in the world. And thank you for your time. Thank you to Stephen. And we'll see you next time. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.